received their unequivocal advice to reinforce.
Commander Lee.
All gazes shifted toward the young naval officer. I noticed the stiffness of posture and scowls of the senior military men, and suddenly realized that Lee was there at the invitation of the CEO, rather than the benevolence of his superiors. I remembered that Gladstone had been quoted as saying that young Commander Lee showed the kind of initiative and intelligence which Force had sometimes lacked. I suspected that the man's career was forfeit for attending this meeting. Commander William Ajunta Lee shifted uncomfortably in his comfortable chair.
With all due respect, CEO, I'm a mere junior naval officer, and I'm not qualified to give an opinion on matters of such strategic importance.
Gladstone did not smile. Her nod was almost imperceptible.
I appreciate that, Commander. I am sure your superiors here do also. However, in this case, I wonder if you would indulge me and comment on the issue at hand.
Lee sat upright. For an instant, his eyes held both conviction and the desperation of a small, trapped animal.
Well then, CEO, if I must comment, I have to say that my own instincts, and they are only instincts, I am profoundly ignorant of interstellar tactics, would advise me against this reinforcement.
Lee took a breath.
This is a purely military assessment, CEO. I know nothing of the political ramifications of defending Hyperion system.
Gladstone leaned forward.
Then on a purely military basis, Commander, why do you oppose the reinforcements?
From where I sat half a table away, I could feel the impact of the Force Chief's gazes, like one of the 100 million joule laser blasts used to ignite deuterium-tritium spheres in one of the ancient inertial confinement fusion reactors. I was amazed that Lee did not collapse, implode, ignite, and fuse before our very eyes.
On a military basis,
Lee said, his eyes hopeless but his voice steady.
The two biggest sins one can commit are to divide one's forces and to, as you put it, CEO, put all of your eggs in a single basket. And in this case, the basket is not even of our own making.
Gladstone nodded and sat back, steepling her fingers beneath her lower lip.
Commander,
said General Morpurgo, and I discovered that a word could indeed be spat.
Now that we have the benefit of your advice, could I ask if you have ever been involved in a space battle?
No, sir. Have you ever been trained for a space battle, Commander? Except for the minimal amount required in OCS, which amounts to a few history courses, no, sir, I have not.
Have you ever been involved in any strategic planning above the level of... How many naval surface ships did you command on Maui, Covenant, Commander?
One, sir.
One, breathed Morpurgo.
A large ship, Commander?
No, sir.
Were you given command of this ship, Commander? Did you earn it? Or did it fall to you through the vicissitudes of war?
Our captain was killed, sir. I took command by default. It was the final naval action of the Maui Covenant campaign, and...
That will be all, Commander.
Morpurgo turned his back on the war hero and addressed the CEO.
Do you wish to poll us again, ma'am?
Gladstone shook her head. Senator Kolchev cleared his throat.
Perhaps we should have a closed cabinet meeting at Government House.
No need, said Mayna Gladstone. I've decided. Admiral Singh, you are authorized to divert as many fleet units to the Hyperion system as you and the Joint Chiefs see fit.
Yes, CEO.
Admiral Nishita, I will expect a successful termination of hostilities within one standard week of the time you have adequate reinforcements.
She looked around the table.
Ladies and gentlemen, I cannot stress to you enough the importance of our possession of Hyperion and the deterrent of ouster threats once and for all.
She rose and walked to the base of the ramp, leading up and out into the darkness.
Good evening, gentlemen, ladies.
It was almost 0400 hours Web and Tau SETI Center time when Hunt rapped at my door. I had been fighting sleep for the 3 hours since we cast back. I had just decided that Gladstone had forgotten about me and was beginning to doze when the knock came.
"The garden," said Leigh Hunt. "And for God's sake, tuck your shirt in."
My boots made soft noises on the fine gravel of the path as I wandered the dark lanes. The lanterns and glow-globes barely emitted light. The stars were not visible above the courtyard because of the glare of T.C. Squared's interminable cities, but the running lights of the orbital habitations moved across the sky like an endless ring of fireflies. Gladstone was sitting on the iron bench near the bridge.
"M. Severn," she said, her voice low, "thank you for joining me. I apologize for it being so late. The cabinet meeting just broke up."
I said nothing and remained standing.
"I wanted to ask about your visit to Hyperion this morning," she chuckled in the darkness. "Yesterday morning. Did you have any impressions?"
I wondered what she meant. My guess was that the woman had an insatiable appetite for data, no matter how seemingly irrelevant.
"I did meet someone," I said.
"Oh?"
"Yes. Dr. Melio Arendaz. He was, is..."
"A friend of M. Weintraub's daughter," finished Gladstone. "The child who was aging backward. Do you have any updates on her condition?"
"Not really," I said. "I had a brief nap today, but the dreams were fragmented."
"And what did the meeting with Dr. Arendaz accomplish?"
I rubbed my chin with fingers suddenly gone cold.
"His research team has been waiting in the capital for months," I said. "They may be our only hope for understanding what's going on with the tombs and the shrike."
"Our predictors say that it is important that the pilgrims be left alone until their act is played out," came Gladstone's voice in the darkness. She seemed to be looking to the side, toward the stream.
I felt sudden, inexplicable, implacable anger surge through me.
"Father Hoyt is already played out," I said more sharply than I intended. "They could have saved him if the ship had been allowed to rendezvous with the pilgrims. Arendaz and his people might be able to save the baby, Rachel, even though there are only a few days left."
"Less than 3 days," said Gladstone.
"Was there anything else? Any impressions of the planet, or Admiral Nishita's command ship, which you found
interesting?"
My hands clenched into fists, relaxed. "You won't allow Arendaz to fly up to the tombs?"
"Not now, no."
"What about the evacuation of civilians from Hyperion, at least the hegemony citizens?"
"That is not a possibility at this time."
I started to say something, checked myself. I stared at the sound of the water beneath the bridge.
"No other impressions, M. Severn?"
"No."
"Well, I wish you a good night and pleasant dreams. Tomorrow may be a very hectic day, but I do want to talk to you about those dreams at some point."
"Good night," I said, and turned on my heel and walked quickly back to my wing of Government House. In the darkness of my room, I called up a Mozart sonata and took 3 tricecobarbitols. Most probably, they would knock me out in a drugged, dreamless sleep, where the ghost of dead Johnny Keats and his even more ghostly pilgrims could not find me. It meant disappointing Mena Gladstone, and that did not dismay me in the least. I thought of Swift Sailor, Gulliver, and his disgust with mankind after his return from the land of the intelligent horses, the Houyhnhnms, a disgust with his own species, which grew to the point that he had to sleep in the stables with the horses just to be reassured by their smell and presence. My last thought before sleep was, to hell with Mena Gladstone, to hell with the war, and to hell with the web, and to hell with dreams.
Part 2. 16. Braun Lamia slept fitfully just before dawn, and her dreams were filled with images and sounds from elsewhere, half-heard and little-understood conversations with Mayna Gladstone, a room that seemed to be floating in space, a movement of men and women along corridors where the walls whispered like a poorly tuned fat-line receiver. And underlying the feverish dreams and random images was the maddening sense that Johnny, her Johnny, was so close, so close. Lamia cried out in her sleep, but the noise was lost in the random echoes of the Sphinx's cooling stones and shifting sands. Lamia awoke suddenly, coming completely conscious as surely as a solid-state instrument switching on. Saul Weintraub had been supposed to be standing guard, but now he slept near the low door of the room where the group sheltered. His infant daughter, Rachel, slept between blankets on the floor next to him. Her rump was raised, face pressed against the blanket, a slight bubble of saliva on her lips. Lamia looked around. In the dim illumination from a low-wattage glow-globe and the faint daylight reflected down 4 meters of corridor, only one other of her fellow pilgrims was visible, a dark bundle on the stone floor. Martin Silenus lay there snoring. Lamia felt a surge of fear, as if she had been abandoned while sleeping. Silenus saw the baby. She realized that only the consul was missing. Attrition had eaten at the pilgrimage party of 7 adults and an infant. Hetmastine missing on the wind wagon crossing of the Sea of Grass. Lenar Hoyt killed the night before. Kassad missing later that night. The consul. Where was the consul? Braun Lamia looked around again, satisfied herself that the dark room held nothing but packs, blanket bundles, the sleeping poet, scholar, and child. And then she rose, found her father's automatic pistol amidst the tumble of blankets, felt in her pack for the neural stunner, and then slipped past Weintraub and the baby into the corridor beyond. It was morning, and so bright out that Lamia had to shield her eyes with her hand as she stepped from the Sphinx's stone steps onto the hard-packed trail which led away down the valley. The storm had passed. Hyperion skies were a deep, crystalline lapis lazuli, shot through with green. Hyperion star, a brilliant white point source just rising above the eastern cliff walls. Rock shadows blended with the outflung silhouettes of the time tombs across the valley floor. The jade tomb sparkled. Lamia could see the fresh drifts and dunes deposited by the storm, white and vermilion sands blending in sensuous curves and striations around stone. There was no evidence of their campsite the night before. The consul sat on a rock 10 meters down the hill. He was gazing down the valley, and smoke spiraled upward from his pipe. Slipping the pistol in her pocket with the stunner, Lamia walked down the hill to him. "No sign of Colonel Kassad," said the consul, as she approached. He did not turn around. Lamia looked down the valley to where the crystal monolith stood. Its once gleaming surface was pocked and pitted. The upper 20 or 30 meters appeared to be missing, and debris still smoked at its base. The half-kilometer or so between the Sphinx and the monolith were scorched and cratered. "It looks as if he didn't leave without a fight," she said. The consul grunted. The pipe smoke made Lamia hungry. "I searched as far as the Shrike Palace, 2 clicks down the valley," said the consul. "The locus of the firefight seems to have been the monolith. There's still no sign of a ground-level opening to the thing, but there are enough holes farther up now so that you can see the honeycomb pattern which deep radar has always shown inside." "But no sign of Kassad?" "None. Blood? Scorched bones? A note saying that he'd be back after delivering his laundry?" "Nothing." Braun Lamia sighed and sat on a boulder near the consul's rock. The sun was warm on her skin. She squinted out toward the opening to the valley. "Well, hell," she said. "What do we do next?" The consul removed his pipe, frowned at it, and shook his head. "I tried the comlog relay again this morning, but the ship is still penned in." He shook ashes out. "Tried the emergency bands, too. But obviously we're not getting through.
Either the ship isn't relaying, or people have orders not to respond.
Would you really leave?
The consul shrugged. He had changed from his diplomatic finery of the day before into a rough wool pullover tunic top, gray whipcord trousers and high boots. Having the ship here would give us you the option of leaving. I wish the others would consider going. After all, Mastine's missing. Hoyt and Cassad are gone. I'm not sure what to do next, a deep voice said.
We could try making breakfast.
Lamia turned to watch Saul come down the path. Rachel was in the infant carrier on the scholar's chest. Sunlight glinted on the older man's balding head. Not a bad idea, she said. Do we have enough provisions left?
Enough for breakfast, said Weintraub. Then a few more meals of cold food packs from the colonel's extra provisions bag. Then we'll be eating googlepeds and each other.
The consul attempted a smile, set the pipe back in his tunic pocket.
I suggest we walk back to Kronos Keep before we reach that point. We'd used up the freeze-dried foods from the Benares, but there were storerooms at the keep.
I'd be happy to, began Lamia, but was interrupted by a shout from inside the Sphinx. She was the first to reach the Sphinx, and she had the automatic pistol in her hand before she went through the entrance. The corridor was dark, the sleeping room darker, and it took a second for her to realize that no one was there. Braun Lamia crouched, swinging the pistol toward the dark curve of corridor, even as Silenus' voice again shouted, "Hey, come here!" from somewhere out of sight. She looked over her shoulder as the consul came through the entrance. "Wait there," snapped Lamia, and moved quickly down the corridor, staying against the wall, pistol extended, propulsion charge primed, safety off. She paused at the open doorway to the small room where Hoyt's body lay, crouched, swung around and in with weapon tracking. Martin Silenus looked up from where he crouched by the corpse. The fiber-plastic sheet they had used to cover the priest's body lay crumpled and lifted in Silenus's hand. He stared at Lamia, looked without interest at the gun, and gazed back at the body. "Do you believe this?" he said softly. Lamia lowered the weapon and came closer. Behind them, the consul peered in. Braun could hear Saul Weintraub in the corridor. The baby was crying. "My God," said Braun Lamia, and crouched next to the body of Father Lenar Hoyt. The young priest's pain-ravaged features had been re-sculpted into the face of a man in his late 60s. High brow, long aristocratic nose, thin lips with a pleasant upturn at the corners, sharp cheekbones, sharp ears under a fringe of gray hair, large eyes under lids as pale and thin as parchment. The consul crouched near them.
"I've seen Hollows. It's Father Paul Duray."
"Look," said Martin Silenus. He lowered the sheet further, paused, and then rolled the corpse on its side. Two small cruciforms on this man's chest pulsed pinkly, just as Hoyt's had, but his back was bare. Saul stood by the door, hushing Rachel's cries with gentle bouncing and whispered syllables. When the infant was silent, he said,
"I thought that the Bakura took 3 days to regenerate."
Martin Silenus sighed.
"The Bakura have been resurrected by the cruciform parasites for more than 2 standard centuries. Perhaps it's easier the first time."
"Is he," began Lamia,
"alive?"
Silenus took her hand.
"Feel."
The man's chest rose and fell ever so slightly. The skin was warm to the touch. Heat from the cruciforms under the skin was palpable. Braun Lamia snatched her hand back. The thing that had been the corpse of Father Lenar Hoyt 6 hours earlier opened its eyes.
"Father Duray,"
said Saul, stepping forward. The man's head turned. He blinked, as though the dim light hurt his eyes, then made an unintelligible noise.
"Water,"
said the consul, and reached into his tunic pocket for the small plastic bottle he carried. Martin Silenus held the man's head while the consul helped him drink. Saul came closer, went to one knee, and touched the man's forearm. Even Rachel's dark eyes seemed curious. Saul said,
"If you can't speak, blink twice for yes. Once for no." Are you Duray?
The man's head swiveled toward the scholar.
Yes,
he said softly, his voice deep, tones cultured.
I am Father Paul Duray.
Breakfast consisted of the last cup of coffee, bits of meat fried over the unfolded heating unit, a scoop of grain mix with rehydrated milk, and the end of their last loaf of bread, torn into five chunks. Lamia thought that it was delicious. They sat at the edge of shade under the Sphinx's outflung wing, using a low, flat-topped boulder as their table. The sun climbed toward mid-morning, and the sky remained cloudless. There was no sound except for the occasional clink of a fork or spoon and the soft tones of their conversation.
You remember? Before?
Asked Saul. The priest wore an extra set of the consul's ship clothes, a gray jumpsuit with the hegemony seal on the left breast. The uniform was a bit too small. Duray held the cup of coffee in both hands, as if he were about to lift it for consecration. He looked up, and his eyes suggested depths of intelligence and sadness in equal measure.
Before I died? Said Duray.
The patrician lips sketched a smile.
Yes, I remember. I remember the exile, the Bakura.
He looked down.
Even the Tesla tree.
Hoyt told us about the tree, said Braun Lamia. The priest had nailed himself onto an active Tesla tree in the flame forests, suffering years of agony, death, resurrection, and death again, rather than give in to the easy symbiosis of life under the cruciform. Duray shook his head.
I thought, in those last seconds, that I had beaten it.
You had, said the consul. Father Hoyt and the others found you. You had driven the thing out of your body. Then the Bakura planted your cruciform on Lenar Hoyt.
Duray nodded.
And there is no sign of the boy.
Martin Silenus pointed toward the man's chest.
Evidently the fucking thing can't defy laws governing conservation of mass. Hoyt's pain had been so great for so long, he wouldn't return to where the thing wanted him to go, that he never gained the weight for a, what the hell would you call it, a double resurrection.
It doesn't matter,
said Duray. His smile was sad.
The DNA parasite in the cruciform has infinite patience. It will reconstitute one host for generations if need be. Sooner or later, both parasites will have a home.
Do you remember anything after the Tesla tree? Asked Saul quietly.
Duray sipped the last of his coffee.
Of death? Of heaven or hell?
The smile was genuine.
No, gentlemen and lady. I wish I could say I did. I remember pain. Eternities of pain. And then release. And then darkness. And then awakening here. How many years did you say have passed?
Almost 12, said the consul. But only about half that for Father Hoyt. He spent time in transit.
Father Duray stood, stretched and paced back and forth. He was a tall man, thin but with a sense of strength about him, and Braun Lamia found herself impressed by his presence, by that strange, inexplicable charisma of personality which had cursed and bestowed power upon a few individuals since time immemorial. She had to remind herself that first, he was a priest of a cult that demanded celibacy from its clerics, and second, an hour earlier he had been a corpse. Lamia watched the older man pace up and down, his movements as elegant and relaxed as a cat's, and she realized that both observations were true, but neither could counteract the personal magnetism the priest radiated. She wondered if the men sensed it. Duray sat on a boulder, stretched his legs straight ahead of him, and rubbed at his thighs as if trying to get rid of a cramp.
"You've told me something about who you are, why you are here," he said. "Can you tell me more?"
The pilgrims glanced at one another. Duray nodded.
Do you think that I'm a monster myself? Some agent of the Shrike? I wouldn't blame you if you did.
We don't think that, said Braun Lamia. The Shrike needs no agents to do his bidding. Besides, we know you from Father Hoyt's story about you and from your journals. She glanced at the others. We found it difficult to tell our stories of why we have come to Hyperion. It would be all but impossible to repeat them.
I made notes on my comm log, said the consul. They're very condensed, but it should make some sense out of our histories. And the history of the last decade of the hegemony. Why the web is at war with the ousters. That sort of thing. You're welcome to access it if you wish. It shouldn't take more than an hour.
I would appreciate it, said Father Duray, and followed the consul back into the Sphinx.
Braun Lamia, Saul, and Silenus walked to the head of the valley. From the saddle between the low cliffs, they could see the dunes and barrens stretching toward the mountains of the Bridal Range, less than 10 clicks to the southwest. The broken globes, soft spires, and shattered galerias of the dead city of poets were visible only 2 or 3 clicks to their right, along a broad ridge which the desert was quietly invading.
I'll walk back to the keep and find some rations, said Lamia.
I hate to split up the group, said Saul. We could all return.
Martin Silenus folded his arms.
Somebody should stay here in case the colonel returns.
Before anyone leaves, said Saul, I think we should search the rest of the valley. The consul didn't check far beyond the monolith this morning.
I agree, said Lamia. Let's get to it before it gets too late. I want to get provisions at the keep and return before nightfall.
They had descended to the Sphinx when Duray and the consul emerged. The priest held the consul's spare comm log in one hand. Lamia explained the plan for a search, and the two men agreed to join them. Once again they walked the halls of the Sphinx, the beams from their hand torches and pencil lasers illuminating sweating stone in bizarre angles. Emerging into noontime sunlight, they made the 300-meter hike to the Jade Tomb. Lamia found herself shivering as they entered the room where the shrike had appeared the night before. Hoyt's blood had left a rust-brown stain on the green ceramic floors. There was no sign of the transparent opening to the labyrinth below. There was no sign of the shrike. The obelisk had no rooms, merely a central shaft in which a spiral ramp, too steep for human comfort, twisted upward between ebony walls. Even whispers echoed here, and the group kept talk to a minimum. There were no windows, no view at the top of the ramp, 50 meters above the stone floor, and their torch beams illuminated only blackness as the roof curved in above them. Fixed ropes and chains left over from 2 centuries of tourism allowed them to descend without undue fear of a slip and fall that would end in death below. As they paused at the entrance, Martin Silenus called Kassad's name a final time, and the echoes followed them into sunlight. They spent half an hour or more inspecting the damage near the crystal monolith. Puddles of sand turned to glass, some 5 to 10 meters across, prismed the noonday light and reflected heat in their faces. The broken face of the monolith, pocked now with holes and still dangling strands of melted crystal, looked like the target of an act of mindless vandalism. But each knew that Kassad must have been fighting for his life. There was no door, no opening to the honeycomb maze within. Instruments told them that the interior was as empty and unconnected as it always had been. They left reluctantly, climbing the steep trails to the base of the north cliffs, where the cave tombs lay separated by less than 100 meters each.
Early archaeologists thought that these were the oldest of the tombs, because of their crudeness, said Saul as they entered the first cave, sent flashlight beams playing across stone, carved in 1,000 indecipherable patterns. None of the caves was deeper than 30 or 40 meters. Each ended in a stone wall that no amount of probing or radar imaging had ever discovered an extension to. Upon exiting the third cave tomb, the group sat in what little shade they could find, and shared water and protein biscuits from Kassad's extra field rations. The wind had risen, and now it sighed and whispered through fluted rock high above them.
"We're not going to find him," said Martin Silenus. "The fucking shrike took him."
Saul was feeding the baby with one of the last nursing packs. The top of her head had been turned pink by the sun, despite Saul's every effort to shield her as they walked outside.
"He could be in one of the tombs we were in," he said, if there are sections out of time phase with us. That's Arendez's theory. He sees the tombs as four-dimensional constructs, with intricate folds through space-time.
Great, said Lamia.
So even if Fedman Kassad is there, we won't see him.
Well, said the consul, getting to his feet with a tired sigh. Let's at least go through the motions. One tomb left.
The Shrike Palace was a kilometer farther down the valley, lower than the others and hidden by a bend in the cliff walls. The structure was not large, smaller than the Jade Tomb, but its intricate construction, flanges, spires, buttresses, and support columns, arching and arcing in controlled chaos, made it seem larger than it was. The interior of the Shrike Palace was one echoing chamber with an irregular floor made up of thousands of curving, jointed segments, which reminded Lamia of the ribs and vertebrae of some fossilized creature. 15 meters overhead, the dome was crisscrossed by dozens of the chrome blades, which continued through walls and each other to emerge as steel-tipped thorns above the structure. The material of the dome itself was slightly opaque, giving a rich, milky hue to the vaulted space. Lamia, Silenus, the consul, Weintraub, and Duray all began to shout for Kassad, their voices echoing and resonating to no avail.
No sign of Kassad or Hetmastine, said the consul as they emerged. Perhaps this will be the pattern, each of us disappearing until only one remains.
And does that final one get his or her wish, as the Shrike cult legends foretell? Asked Braun Lamia. She sat on the rocky hearth to the Shrike palace, her short legs dangling in the air. Paul Duray raised his face to the sky.
I can't believe that it was Father Hoyt's wish that he would die, so that I could live again.
Martin Silenus squinted up at the priest.
So what would your wish be, Padre?
Duray did not hesitate.
I would wish, pray, that God will lift the scourge of these twin obscenities, the war and the shrike, from mankind once and for all.
There was a silence, in which the early afternoon wind inserted its distant sighs and moans.
In the meantime, said Braun Lamia, we've got to get some food, or learn how to subsist on air.
Duray nodded.
Why did you bring so little with you?
Martin Silenus laughed and said loudly,
Ne cared he for wine or half and half, ne cared he for fish or flesh or fowl, and sauces held he worthless as the chaff. He's deigned the swineherd at the wassail bowl. Ne with lewd ribald sat he cheek by jowl, ne with sly lemans in the scorner's chair. But after water brooks this pilgrim soul panted, and all his food was woodland air, though he would oft-times feast on gillyflowers rare.
Duray smiled, obviously still puzzled.
We all expected to triumph or die the first night, said the consul. We hadn't anticipated a long stay here.
Braun Lamia stood and brushed off her trousers. I'm going, she said. I should be able to carry back 4 or 5 days' rations if they're field food packs or the bulk-stored items we saw.
I'll go too, said Martin Silenus.
There was a silence. During the week of their pilgrimage, the poet and Lamia had almost come to blows 6 times. Once she had threatened to kill the man. She looked at him for a long moment. All right, she said at last. Let's stop by the Sphinx to get our packs and water bottles. The group moved up the valley as the shadows began to grow from the western walls. 17. 12 hours earlier, Colonel Fedman Kassad stepped off the spiral staircase onto the highest remaining level of the crystal monolith. Flames rose on all sides. Through gaps he had inflicted on the crystal surface of the structure, Kassad could see darkness. The storm blew vermilion dust through the apertures until it filled the air like powdered blood. Kassad pulled his helmet on. 10 paces in front of him, Moneta awaited. She was nude under the energy skin suit.
and the effect was of quicksilver poured directly on flesh. Kassad could see the flames reflected in the curves of breast and thigh, the bend of light into the hollow of throat and navel. Her neck was long, her face chrome-carved in perfect smoothness. Her eyes held twin reflections of the tall shadow that was Fedmon Kassad. Kassad raised the assault rifle and clicked the selector manually to full-spectrum fire. Inside his activated impact armor, his body clenched in anticipation of attack. Monetta moved her hand, and the skin suit faded from the crown of her head to her neck. She was vulnerable now. Kassad felt that he knew every facet of that face, every pore and follicle. Her brown hair was cut short, falling softly to the left. The eyes were the same large, curious, startling in their green depths. The small mouth with the full underlip still hesitated on the edge of a smile. He noted the slightly inquisitive arch of eyebrows, the small ears he had kissed and whispered in so many times, the soft throat where he had lain his cheek to listen to her pulse. Kassad raised the rifle and aimed it at her. "Who are you?" she asked. Her voice was as soft and sensual as he remembered, the slight accent as elusive. His finger on the trigger, Kassad paused. They had made love scores of times, known each other for years in his dreams and their lover's landscape of the military simulations. But if she were truly moving backward in time... "I know," she said, her voice calm, apparently unaware of the pressure he had already begun to exert on the trigger. "You are the one whom the Lord of Pain has promised." Kassad was gasping for air. When he spoke, his voice was raw and very strained.
"You don't remember me?"
"No." She cocked her head to look at him quizzically. "But the Lord of Pain has promised a warrior. We were destined to meet."
"We met long ago," managed Kassad.
The rifle would automatically aim for the face, shifting wavelengths and frequencies every microsecond until the skin suit defenses were defeated. Along with the hell whip and laser beams, flechettes and pulse bolts would be fired an instant later. "I have no memory of long ago," she said. "We move in opposite directions along the general flow of time. What name do you know me by in my future, your past?"
"Monetta,"
gasped Kassad, willing his straining hand and finger to fire. She smiled, nodded. "Monetta, the child of memory. There is a crude irony there." Kassad remembered her betrayal, the changing as they made love that last time in the sands above the dead city of poets. She had either become the Shrike or allowed the Shrike to take her place. It had turned an act of love into an obscenity. Colonel Kassad pulled the trigger. Monetta blinked. "It will not work here, not within the crystal monolith." "Why do you wish to kill me?" Kassad growled, threw the useless weapon across the landing, directed power to his gauntlets, and charged. Monetta made no move to escape. She watched him charge the 10 paces. His head was down, his impact armor moaning as it changed the crystal alignment of polymers, and Kassad was screaming. She lowered her arms to meet the charge. Kassad's speed and mass knocked Monetta off her feet and sent both of them tumbling. Kassad trying to get his gauntleted hands on her throat, Monetta holding his wrists in a vice-strong grip as they rolled across the landing to the edge of the platform. Kassad rolled on top of her, trying to let gravity add to the force of his attack, arms straight, gauntlets rigid, fingers curved in a killing cusp. His left leg hung over the 60-meter drop to the dark floor below. "Why do you want to kill me?" whispered Monetta, and rolled him to one side, tumbling both of them off the platform. Kassad screamed and flipped down his visor with a snap of his head. They tumbled through space, their legs entwined around each other's bodies in fierce scissors grips. Kassad's hands held at bay by her death hold on his wrists.
time seemed to decelerate as they fell in slow motion, the air moving across Kassat like a blanket being pulled slowly over his face. Then time accelerated, grew normal. They were falling the last 10 meters. Kassat shouted and visualized the proper symbol to let his impact armor go rigid, and there was a terrible crash. From a blood-red distance, Fedman Kassat fought to the surface of consciousness, knowing that only a second or two had elapsed since they had struck the ground. He staggered to his feet. Moneta was also rising slowly, on one bent knee now, staring at the ground where the ceramic floor had been shattered by their fall. Kassad sent power to the servo mechanisms in his suit leg and kicked at her head with full force. Moneta dodged the blow, caught his leg, twisted, and sent him crashing into the 3-meter square of crystal, shattering it, tumbling him out into the sand and the night. Moneta touched her neck. Her face flowed with quicksilver, and she stepped out after him. Kassad flipped up his shattered visor, removed the helmet. The wind tousled his short, black hair, and sand grated against his cheeks. He got to his knees, his feet. Telltales in the suit's collar display were blinking red, announcing the last reservoirs of power draining away. Kassat ignored the alarms. There would be enough for the next several seconds, and that would be all that mattered. "Whatever happened in my future, your past," said Moneta. "It was not I who changed. I am not the Lord of Pain. He—" Kassad jumped the 3 meters that separated them, landed behind Moneta, and brought the killing gauntlet on his right hand around in an arc that broke the sound barrier, palm edge rigid and sharp as carbon-carbon piezoelectric filaments could make it. Moneta did not duck or attempt to block the attack. Kassad's gauntlet caught the base of her neck in a blow which would have severed a tree, carved through 0.5 meter of stone. On Brescia, in hand-to-hand combat in the capital of Buckminster, Kassad had killed an ouster colonel so quickly, his gauntlet cutting through impact armor, helmet, personal force field, flesh and bone without pause, that the man's head had blinked up at his own body for 20 seconds before death claimed him. Kassad's blow struck true, but stopped at the surface of the quicksilver skin suit. Moneta did not stagger or react. Kassad felt his suit power fail at the same instant his arm went numb, his shoulder muscles wrenching in agony. He staggered back, his right arm dead at his side, the suit power draining like blood from an injured man. "You don't listen," said Moneta. She stepped forward, grabbed Kassad by the front of his combat suit, and threw him 20 meters toward the jade tomb. He landed hard, the impact armor stiffening to absorb only part of the collision as power reserves failed. His left arm protected his face and neck, but then the armor locked up, his arm bent uselessly under him. Moneta jumped the 20 meters, crouched next to him, lifted him into the air with one hand, grabbed a handful of impact armor with the other hand, and ripped his combat suit down the front, tearing apart 200 layers of microfilaments and omega cloth polymers. She slapped him gently, almost lackadaisically. Kassad's head snapped around and he almost lost consciousness. Wind and sand pelted the bare flesh of his chest and belly. Moneta tore the rest of the suit off, ripping off biosensors and feedback teeps. She lifted the naked man by his upper arms and shook him. Kassad tasted blood, and red dots swam in his field of vision. "We didn't have to be enemies," she said softly.
"You fired at me."
"To test your responses, not to kill you." Her mouth moved normally under its quicksilver caul. She slapped him again and Kassad flew 2 meters in the air to land on a dune, rolled downhill in the cold sand. The air was filled with 1,000,000 specks, snow, dust, pinwheels of colored light. Kassad rolled over, fought his way to his knees, gripped the shifting dune sand with fingers turned to numbed claws. "Kassad," whispered Moneta. He rolled onto his back, waiting. She had deactivated the skin suit.
Her flesh looked warm and vulnerable, the skin so pale as to be almost translucent. There were soft blue veins visible along the tops of her perfect breasts. Her legs looked strong, carefully sculpted, the thighs separated slightly where they met her body. Her eyes were a dark green. "You love war, Kasad," whispered Moneta, as she lowered herself onto him. He struggled, tried to twist aside, raised his arms to strike her. Moneta pinned his arms above his head with one of her hands. Her body was radiant with heat as she brushed her breasts back and forth across his chest, lowered herself between his parted legs. Kasad could feel the slight curve of her belly against his abdomen. He realized then that this was a rape, that he could fight back simply by not responding, refusing her. It did not work. The air seemed liquid around them, the windstorm a distant thing, sand hanging in the air like a lace curtain borne aloft by steady breezes. Moneta moved back and forth above him, against him. Kasad could feel the slow, clockwise stir of his excitement. He fought it, fought her, wrestled and kicked and struggled to free his arms. She was much stronger. She used her right knee to brush his leg aside. Her nipples rubbed across his chest like warm pebbles. The warmth of her belly and groin made his flesh react like a flower twisting toward the light.
"No!"
screamed Fedmon Kasad, but was silenced as Moneta lowered her mouth to his. With her left hand, she continued to pin his arms above him. With her right hand, she moved between them, found him, guided him. Kasad bit at her lip as warmth enveloped him. His struggles brought him closer, sent him deeper into her. He tried to relax, and she lowered herself on him until his back was pressed into the sand. He remembered the other times they had made love, finding sanity in each other's warmth while war raged beyond the circle of their passion. Kasad closed his eyes, arched his neck back to postpone the agony of pleasure which closed on him like a wave. He tasted blood on his lips, whether his or hers he did not know. A minute later, the two of them still moving together, Kasad realized that she had released his arms. Without hesitating, he brought both arms down, around, fingers flat against her back, and roughly pressed her closer to him, slid one hand higher to cup the back of her neck with gentle pressure. The wind resumed, sound returned, sand blew from the edge of the dune in curls of spindrift. Kasad and Moneta slid lower on the gently curling bank of sand, rolled together down the warm wave to the place where it would break, oblivious of the night, the storm, the forgotten battle, and everything, except the moment and each other. Later, walking together through the shattered beauty of the crystal monolith, she touched him once with a golden ferrule, once more with a blue torus. He watched in the shard of a crystal panel as his reflection became a quicksilver sketch of a man, perfect down to the details of his gender and the lines where his ribs showed on the slender torso.
"What now?"
asked Kasad through the medium that was neither telepathy nor sound. "The Lord of Pain awaits."
"You are its servant?"
"Never. I am his consort and nemesis, his keeper."
"You came from the future with it?"
"No. I was taken from my time to travel back in time with him."
"Then who were you before?"
Kasad's question was interrupted by the sudden appearance. No, he thought. The sudden presence, not appearance, of the Shrike. The creature was as he remembered it from their first encounter years before. Kasad noticed the quicksilver over chrome slickness of the thing, so similar to their own skin suits. But he knew intuitively that there was no mere flesh and bone beneath that carapace. It stood at least 3 meters tall. The four arms seemed normal on the elegant torso, and the body was a sculpted mass of thorns, spikes, joints, and layers of ragged razor wire. The thousand-faceted eyes burned with a light that might have been made by a ruby laser. the long jaw and layers of teeth were the stuff of nightmare. Kassad stood ready. If the skin suit gave him the same strength and mobility it had afforded Moneta, he might at least die fighting. There was no time for that. One instant the Lord of Pain stood 5 meters away across black tile, and the next instant it was beside Kassad, gripping the colonel's upper arm in a steel-bladed vice that sank through the skin suit field and drew blood from his biceps. Kassad tensed, waiting for the blow and determined to strike back, even though to do so meant impaling himself on blades, thorns, and razor wire. The shrike lifted its right hand, and a 4-meter rectangular field portal came into existence. It was similar to a Farcaster portal, except for the violet glow which filled the interior of the monolith with thick light. Moneta nodded at him and stepped through. The shrike stepped forward, finger blades cutting only slightly into Kassad's upper arm. Kassad considered pulling back, realized that curiosity was stronger in him than an urge to die, and stepped through with the shrike. 18. CEO Mena Gladstone could not sleep. She rose, dressed quickly in her dark apartments deep in Government House, and did what she often did when sleep would not come. She walked the worlds. Her private Farcaster portal pulsed into existence. Gladstone left her human guards sitting in the anteroom, taking with her only one of the micro-remotes. She would have taken none if the laws of the hegemony and the rule of the Technocorps would allow it. They did not. It was far past midnight on TC Squared, but she knew that many of the worlds would be in daylight, so she wore a long cape with a Renaissance privacy collar. Her trousers and boots revealed neither gender nor class, although the quality of the cape itself might mark her in some places. CEO Gladstone stepped through the one-time portal, sensing rather than seeing or hearing the micro-remote as it buzzed through behind her, climbing for altitude and invisibility as she stepped out into the square of St. Peter's in the new Vatican on Pacem. For a second, she did not know why she had coded her implant for that destination, the presence of that obsolete Monsignor at the dinner on God's Grove. But then she realized that she had been thinking of the pilgrims as she lay awake, thinking of the 7 who left 3 years earlier to meet their fate on Hyperion. Pacem had been the home of Father Lennar Hoyt and the other priest before him, Duray. Gladstone shrugged under the cape and crossed the square. Visiting the homeworlds of the pilgrims was as good a schematic for her walk as any. Most sleepless nights saw her walking a score of worlds, returning just before dawn and the first meetings on Tau Ceti Center. At least this would be but 7 worlds. It was early here. The skies of Pacem were yellow, tinged with greenish clouds, and an ammonia smell which attacked her sinuses and made her eyes water. The air had that thin, foul, chemical smell of a world neither completely terraformed nor totally inimical to man. Gladstone paused to look around. St. Peter's was on a hilltop, the square embraced by a semicircle of pillars, a great basilica at its cusp. To her right were the pillars open to a staircase descending a kilometer or more to the south. A small city was visible, low, crude homes huddling between bone-white trees that resembled the skeletons of stunted creatures long since departed. Only a few people could be seen, hurrying across the square or ascending the stairs as if late for services. Bells somewhere under the great dome of the cathedral began to toll, but the thin air leached the sound of any authority. Gladstone walked the circle of pillars, head down, ignoring the curious glances of clerics and the street-sweeping crew, who rode a beast resembling a half-ton hedgehog. There were scores of marginal worlds like Pacem in the Web, more in the Protectorate and nearby Outback, too poor to be attractive to an infinitely mobile citizenry, too earth-like to be ignored during the dark days of the Hegira. It had fit a small group like the Catholics, who had come here seeking a resurgence of faith. They had numbered in the millions then, Gladstone knew. There could be no more than a few tens of thousands now. She closed her eyes and recalled Dossier Hollows of Father Paul Duret. Gladstone loved the web. She loved the human beings in it. For all their shallowness and selfishness and inability to change, they were the stuff of humankind. Gladstone loved the web. She loved it enough to know that she must help in destroying it. She returned to the small three-portal Terminex, brought her own Farcaster Nexus into existence with a simple override command to the datasphere, and stepped through into sunlight and the smell of the sea. Maui Covenant. Gladstone knew precisely where she was. She stood on a hill above First Sight, where Ceres' tomb still marked the spot where the short-lived rebellion had begun the better part of a century ago. At that time, First Sight was a village of a few thousand, and each festival week, flutists welcomed the Motal Isles as they were herded north to their feeding grounds in the equatorial archipelago. Now, First Sight stretched out of view around the island, arc towns and residential hives rising half a kilometer in all directions, towering over the hill which had once commanded the best view on the SeaWorld of Maui Covenant. But the tomb remained. The body of the consul's grandmother was no longer there, never really had been there. But like so many symbolic things from this world, the empty crypt commanded reverence, almost awe. Gladstone looked out between the towers, out past the old breakwater, where blue lagoons had been turned brown, out past the drilling platforms and tourist barges, out to where the sea began. There were no Motal Isles now. They no longer moved in great herds across the oceans, their tree sails billowing to southern breezes, their dolphin herders cutting the water in white V's of foam. The isles were tamed and populated by web citizens now. The dolphins were dead, some killed in the great battles with force, most killing themselves in the inexplicable South Sea mass suicide, the last mystery of a race draped in mysteries. Gladstone took a seat on a low bench near the cliff's edge and found a stalk of grass she could peel and chew. What happened to a world when it went from a home for 100,000 humans, in delicate balance with a delicate ecology, to the playground for more than 400 million in the first standard decade of citizenship in the hegemony? Answer? The world died. Or its soul did, even as the ecosphere continued to function after a fashion. Planetary ecologists and terraform specialists kept the husk alive, kept the seas from choking completely on the unavoidable garbage and sewage and oil spills, worked to minimize or disguise the noise pollution and a thousand other things which progress had brought. But the Maui Covenant that the consul had known as a child less than a century earlier, climbing this very hill to his grandmother's funeral, was gone forever. A formation of hawking mats flew overhead, the tourists on them laughing and shouting. Far above them, a massive excursion EMV occluded the sun for a moment. In the sudden shadow, Gladstone tossed down her stalk of grass and rested her forearms on her knees. She thought of the consul's betrayal. She had counted on the consul's betrayal, had wagered everything on the man raised on Maui Covenant, descendant of Ciri, joining the ousters in the inevitable battle for Hyperion. It had not been her plan alone. Lee Hunt had been instrumental in the decades of planning, the delicate surgery of placing the precise individual in contact with the ousters, in a position where he might betray both sides by activating the ouster device to collapse the time tides on Hyperion. And he had. The consul, a man who had given 4 decades of his life as well as his wife and child to hegemony service, had finally exploded in revenge like a bomb which had lain dormant for half a century. Gladstone took no pleasure in the betrayal. The consul had sold his soul and would pay a terrible price, in history, in his own mind. But his treason was as nothing to the treachery Gladstone was prepared to suffer for. As hegemony's CEO, she was the symbolic leader of 150 billion human souls. She was prepared to betray them all in order to save humanity.